Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, November 15th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Looking at the weather forecast for today, cold November weather continues today, with plenty of clouds in this morning. There may be a few flurries with the clouds, but those are expected to have essentially no impact on your day. Plan on a day only around 40 degrees, with 30s likely over the entire north half of the area. Looking ahead, tomorrow continues to look warmer as highs surge well into the 50s, then right back down to the 40s again on Wednesday. There may be an isolated shower as that front passes tomorrow night, but that too appears to carry no impact with it. Cold and windy weather is likely again by Thursday. Our front page today has three stories: Cedar Falls Residence Gives Her All, A House of Stories, and we will begin reading Cedar Falls Main Street on Council Agenda. Main Street Roundabouts to be discussed Monday at Cedar Falls City Council meeting. This story was filed by Andy Malone. Cedar Falls, a longer-than-usual agenda comes before the City Council on Monday, beginning with a presentation and possible vote on the future look of Main Street. The Committee of the Whole meeting starts at 5:45 p.m. in City Hall. Aaron Maniza, an engineering consultant with the firm Foth, leads off the evening with a 50-minute update on the roundabouts and other improvements involved in the reconstruction of Main Street from Searley Boulevard to 6th Street. A traffic study was completed in 2017, leading the council to eventually move forward with plans to add to Main Street a three-lane corridor with an on-street bikes lanes, as well as roundabouts at the intersections with 12th and 18th Streets and Searley Boulevard. The council also requested plans for a roundabout for the intersection with 6th Street. In addition, presentation bullet points bring up the possible private property acquisitions, temporary easements, and city property that would be required for the four future roundabouts. The consultant will recommend the council proceed with the final design of the 6th Street roundabout. On December 6th, the council would also vote on any acquisitions involved in the Main Street reconstruction. If all moves forward as planned, construction would begin in spring of 2023. A second item on the Committee of the Whole agenda is a 15-minute discussion on the fiscal year 2021 audit led by City Treasurer and Controller Lisa Redding. The regular meeting starts at 7 p.m. and includes condemnation hearings on four nuisance properties, and they are 1227 West 22nd Street and 315 East Dunkerton Road, as well as two that neighbor each other, 710 West 13th Street and 1303 Walnut Street, with structures that staff says have issues that could be abated by December 2nd or else be possibly demolished entirely. Other agenda items on the annual report for housing repair and rehabilitation programs geared toward the low to moderate income, a 5-year property tax exemption schedule for the Vault LLC for its construction of a storage office facility at 6100 Production Drive, and the plans for a roundabout at the Green Road and South Main Street intersection. Other noteworthy items up for consideration include a mayoral recommendation to appoint resident Sonia Bach, the president of the African American Culture Center in Waterloo, to a vacant seat on the Human Rights Commission, and an ordinance on first reading establishing 7% annual increases in sanitary sewer rates for the next 5 years in support of major nutrient reduction wastewater treatment facility upgrades costing more than $110 million. About a dozen resolutions deal with the city's 5 tax increment financing districts, and more specifically, different interfund loans and various projects in those areas. In addition, some 10 other resolutions will be considered by the council, including one that would accept a $3,851,456 bid by Peters Construction Corporation for the construction work related to the remodeling of City Hall. The total project cost is expected to be north of $4.5 million. The next story was filed by Melody Parker, A House of Stories. Earth is a House of Stories features Native artists at University of Northern Iowa Gallery of Art. Cedar Falls. Works by historical and contemporary Native American artists are being showcased at the University of Northern Iowa Gallery of Art. Quote, "The Earth is a House of Stories" features numerous pieces from the permanent art collection and will be open from December 2nd through the 15th in the Mary Haskell Hansen Room at the gallery, located in the Kamerick Art Building. Quote, "In the 21 years I've been here, these pieces have never been shown together. Some of the pieces have never been shown. Some might have been a part of other exhibitions, but they haven't been shown all at once before. It was interesting going so deep into the collection to bring out this artwork for students and the public to enjoy," said Daryl Taylor, UNI Gallery of Art Director. Taylor co-created the show with UNI alumnus Angela Wisecuck. The exhibition also incorporates pieces from the UNI Museum. The title is taken from N. Scott Momaday's book, quote, "Earth Keeper, Reflections on the American Land," unquote. Momaday, Kiowa, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and poet and recipient of a 2007 National Medal of Arts. A watercolor painting of a dancer by Percy Sesti Sandy, a Zuni, for example, was removed from a storage drawer in the collection to be placed in the public eye for the first time, Taylor said. Sandy, who died in 1974 in Taos, New Mexico, was known for a loose and natural style, using bright colors in a nearly translucent manner. Five George Longfish acrylic paintings on paper and canvas are housed in the permanent collection, and Taylor was thrilled to be able to exhibit pieces by the artist. Longfish is an internationally known First Nations artist, curator, and professor emeritus at the University of California, Davis. His paintings are often brightly colored with text and assemblage. Featured in the UNI show, Bag a Red Heart for Valentine features Native imagery and spirit animals, as well as two boxes of Sweetheart Candy Hearts. A second Longfish work is titled, I Want to Dance with the Rosebud Sioux This Summer. Red Laughter, acrylic on linen, by nationally known artist Dwayne Slick, a Waterloo native, is on display in the gallery collection. A major show featuring Slick's art was on display this fall and recently closed at the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls. Slick, a UNI graduate, is a professor at the Rhode Island School of Design in Providence, Rhode Island. He belongs to the Meskwaki Nation in Iowa. Through his father and through his mother, the Ho-Chunk Nation in Nebraska. Quick to See Smith's contemporary abstract oil-on-canvas painting, Alphabet, is on display. Smith is known for her work that addresses myths of her ancestors in the context of current issues facing Native Americans, according to the National Museum of Women in the Arts. Taylor also chose a ceramic reduction-fired black ware pot with designs created by Sheila Arch for the exhibition. Works on loan from the UNI Museum Director Robert Wisecuck and co-curator Angela Wisecuck include objects by artists Maria Martinez, Joe Campbell, Wendy Redstar, and Leonard Youngbear. In August, the gallery hosted the UNI and Meskwaki Tribal Council Mission Stewardship Festivities. The event also featured a performance by world champion fancy dancer Larry Yazzi. In addition to providing an opportunity for students to repeatedly view and study various artwork on display for coursework, showcasing the works is part of a university-wide effort to adopt a land stewardship statement. Quote, "While continuing to build and honor respectful and nourishing partnerships with the Meskwaki Nation and Native people in Iowa." Gallery hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, and by appointment. Admission is free. Visitors are asked to wear a mask and maintain physical distance while in the gallery. Next, we have the Courier's next installment in the 20 Under 40 series. Amanda Lynch, leader, approaches profession community involvement with passion. This story was filed by Nancy Newhoff. Cedar Falls hit the jackpot with one of its own, a native resident who loves her town, loves her profession and employer, and works hard to make her community a better place to live. Quote, if leadership can be defined as seeing what needs to be done and doing it, there is no question that Amanda Lynch is an outstanding leader, said Richard Congdon of Cedar Falls, who nominated Lynch for a 20 Under 40 award. Quote, in all my 60 years as a business person, I have never met anyone more deserving of this honor than she. Lynch, 34, is head of a new program at Western Home Communities called Fortified Life. She began work at Western Home in 2012, 2 years out of college, as the company's first wellness coordinator. As she grew that program, bringing wellness education to residents and staff, she and CEO Chris Hansen developed the new Fortified Life program, which launched in July. It brings Western Home services and wellness programming to residents who want to stay in their own homes. For Lynch, it was one more step in allowing her to lead people, residents, and employees through personal growth. Quote, it's really been an interesting process to see their growth and see just the changes that they can make, even if it's small changes, which is what I am all about. I don't want to try to climb the mountain in one day. I'd rather love the process and love being able to climb the mountain for however long it takes, she said. A 2006 graduate of Cedar Falls High School, Lynch went to the University of Northern Iowa on a swimming scholarship and thought she might want to become a pharmacist like her father, Steve Furman. But along the way, she fell in love with kinesiology, the study of body movement and exercise. After graduation, she first decided to pursue another passion, politics, and became clerk to the Senator Jeff Danielson in the Iowa legislature. Quote, I loved my time there, and in all actuality, it was my second passion in life. To learn the process of legislation taught me so much. Public service is really important to me. It's something I enjoy a lot. So being able to be mentored by Jeff was absolutely fantastic, unquote. In her second year of clerking, she met Chris Hansen, CEO of Western Home Communities, and the two began discussing the concept of wellness education and Hansen's passion to bring it to Western Home. It was a perfect fit for her. Quote, I was hired on 2012, and I don't foresee myself ever leaving this place. Western Home is definitely my family. It's been in my family for a long time. My grandfather worked here. My uncle worked here. That's what we are. We are a family business, all the way down to taking care of our residents, she said. In 2017, Hansen steered Lynch to the Cedar Valley Leadership Institute, a 9-month program through Grow Cedar Valley designed to foster community awareness and develop leadership skills. Quote, that program I took very seriously from a networking perspective. I wanted to meet as many people in the Cedar Valley as I could. It's great to say you are from Cedar Valley, but I know different things, and a lot of people don't know because of that program, she said. She is past president and current board member of the Cedar Trails Partnership and is currently a member of the Cedar Falls Planning and Zoning Commission. Quote, the learning curve was straight up when I first started on the Planning Commission, but I was given the opportunity and just feel forever grateful. I'll be honest, for me, this has been the most eye-opening piece of Cedar Falls and why I love Cedar Falls so much, and I don't ever plan to leave. Being a native person, it's really interesting to see how we've planned things and looking to the future and how we want to set our town up for success for many years to come. I am just happy to be part of that, she said. Nominator Carrie Dara, president and CEO of Grow Cedar Valley, said Lynch shows her leadership in many ways. She has been a facilitator for Women in Leadership with Grow Cedar Valley, which supports women professionally and has been a role model for them as they stay connected. Lynch said there are a few people who have helped mentor her along the way, including Danielson and her boss, Hansen. Quote, he has an amazing vision for not only the Western home, but also the Cedar Valley, and I love that he loves this town as much as I do, she said of Hansen. Quote, he helps me so much in leadership and growing and being able to be the best me. But also watching him and how he leads is something that is beautiful to watch, unquote. She also cited her dad, who was instrumental in her early years and someone she wanted to be like. She cites Dara, a lifelong family friend, whom she has watched grow in her profession. Quote, I'm so proud of where she's at today, and I aspire to do that, Lynch said. And finally, there's her husband, Ryan Lynch, whom she met at UNI and now shares two children with, Madeline, 6, and Rowan, 2. Quote, if there is one person in my life that I am forever thankful for, it would be him. I am not the easiest person to get along with, in a really great way. He supports me. He dreams with me. He's a voice of reason in so many ways for me. He is instrumental in who I am, unquote. Our next story was filed by Hope Yin of the Associated Press. Biden advisor bullish on spending bill. Washington. President Joe Biden's top economic advisor expressed confidence Sunday that the White House's $1.85 trillion domestic policy package will quickly pass the House this week, and said approval couldn't come at a more urgent time as prices of consumer goods spike. Quote, inflation is high right now, and it is affecting customers in their pocketbooks and also in their outlook for the economy, said Brian Deese, director of the National Economic Council. Quote, this, more than anything, will go at the cost that Americans face, he said, before adding that the House will consider the legislation coming this week. Quote, it will get a vote, it will pass, unquote. The House has been moving toward approval of the massive Democrat-only backed bill when, as the measure faces bigger challenges in the Senate, where Senators Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, and Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, have insisted on reducing its size. In a letter Sunday to Democratic colleagues, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, counseled, quote, time and patience for working through a bill of that size. Consumer prices have soared 6.2% over the last year, the biggest 12-month jump since 1990. Deese acknowledged that prices may not fully return to a more normal 2% level until next year due to the lingering effects of COVID-19. But he said the measure will go a long way toward lowering costs for American families. Quote, we're confident that this bill, as it moves through the process, is going to be fully paid for, and not only that, it's actually going to reduce deficits over the long term, he said. Biden, on Monday, planned to sign a related $1 trillion infrastructure bill, a bipartisan effort that was passed earlier this month, after the President and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat from California, pledged action on Biden's broader package expanding health, child, elder care, and climate change by mid-November. House progressives had threatened to hold up the infrastructure bill without a firm commitment of immediate action on the broader package. House centrists said they will vote for the package as early as this week if an incoming presidential budget office analysis affirms White House estimates that the bill is fully paid for. The measure would be covered with changes to corporate taxes, such as a new corporate minimum tax, while raising taxes on higher-income people. On Friday, Pelosi wrote Democratic members reaffirming her plan to push ahead soon, noting that CBO estimates released so far on pieces of the plan have been consistent with White House projections. Quote, we are on a path to be further fortified with numbers from the Congressional Budget Office, she said. Representative Fred Upton, Republican from Michigan, one of 13 House Republicans who voted for the infrastructure bill, said he's not convinced that the broader package will get House approval this week. Quote, I don't think the votes are there yet, he said. A good number of Democrats had demanded, and we are going to receive a CBO report as to whether it is really paid for. What does it do when you expand Medicare? What does that do to solvency? Somehow I don't think we're going to get these answers for Pelosi to get the votes set before the end of the week, unquote. The bill is expected to face changes in the Senate, with Republican opposition to an evenly split 50-50 Senate. Biden has no votes to spare. Manchin, in particular, has been vocal about the risk of aggravating budget shortfalls and already has managed to bring the bill down from Biden's original $3.5 trillion price tag. Last week, Manchin again sounded the alarm over, quote, the threat posed by the record inflation. Deese appeared on CNN's State of the Union and ABC's This Week, and Upton spoke on CNN. Turning the page, we land on a section entitled Northeast Iowa Area Escapades. Here are a few of the events, shenanigans, and goings-on worth checking out this week in the Northeast Iowa area. On Monday, November 15th, UNI Music recital to feature oboist Heather Payton, Associate Professor of Oboe and Music Theory, will present a faculty recital at 6 p.m. tonight in Davis Hall at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center on the University of Northern Iowa campus in Cedar Falls. Payton is a frequent soloist and ensemble performer throughout the United States and has won numerous national and international awards. The recital is free and open to the public. On Tuesday, November 16th, Jeffrey S. Copeland to discuss upcoming book. Cedar Falls author Jeffrey S. Copeland will discuss his latest book, After Jackie, 15 Pioneers Who Helped Change the Face of Baseball, at Cedar Falls Authors Festival on Tuesday. The program begins at 7 p.m. at the Hearst Center for the Arts, 304 West Searley Boulevard. It is free and open to the public. Copeland has written numerous nonfiction books and is a professor in the Languages and Literatures Department at the University of Northern Iowa. Also on Tuesday, November 16th, Grout debuts New World War II exhibit. The Grout Museum District's newest exhibit, Over Land and Sea, Iowans in the Pacific in World War II, will open Tuesday. On December 7th, 1941, the U.S. was attacked at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and was engulfed in war with Japan. More than 285,000 U.S. soldiers fought in the Pacific, and thousands of them were Iowans. Through their stories came the beauty and the horror of the Pacific Theater and what it took for Americans to win the war. Visitors can purchase a replica World War I Medal of Honor to honor a veteran in their lives. The medals will be displayed for the duration of the exhibit through December 31st. Exhibit hours are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., Tuesday through Saturday. Now on Thursday, November 18th, Gary Kelly to read from Moon of the Snowblind. Nationally known illustrator and author Gary Kelly will be featured on the final Thursday reading series at the Hearst Center for the Arts, 304 West Searley Boulevard, Cedar Falls. The evening begins at 7 p.m. with sign-up for open mic, followed by open mic at 7:15 p.m., and Kelly at 8 p.m. He will read from his newest graphic novel, Moon of the Snowblind, the poignant and fair account of a dark moment in Iowa and Midwestern history, the Spirit Lake Massacre in March of 1857. The 184-page book with illustrations and text by Kelly is his first true graphic novel. Now on Saturday, November 20th, shop downtown Waterloo Saturdays. On Saturdays now through December 18th, Waterloo's downtown retailers and pop-up vendors will be perfect shopping destination for the holiday season. Hours are 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday. Check Main Street Waterloo's Facebook page for announcements of specials and activities. Pop-up vendors will be at Lulitz Hair Essence at 200 East 4th Street, number 100, Lux Life Women's Clothing Boutique at 627 Sycamore Street, Unit C, Sherry's Shabby Shack at 328 East 4th Street, and two winter market locations, 204 East 4th Street for paparazzi jewelry, baked goods, pink zebra quilts, and more, and 217 West 4th Street, the location for a winter market featuring baked goods, woodworking, jewelry, and more. Downtown retailers will include Ivy Trellis, Epic Finds, Finery Bridal and Trend Boutique, Earth Beauty Supply, Braylee Rose Beauty Boutique, Macarons by Sani, Oh So In Boutique, and others. Also on Saturday, November 20th, Pinkies Up for Super Tea Party at Grout. Superheroes will be on their best behavior for a Super Tea Party Saturday at the Snowden House, 306 Washington Street. The event is from 10 a.m. to noon for children and adults. The vilest supervillain in the Cedar Valley has kidnapped Mr. Gobblesworth, and Tea Party guests will form a super team to plan and execute a rescue mission. Plenty of fun crafts and activities to help kids crack the case. Registration is required and due Monday, November 15th at www.groutmuseumdistrict.org or by calling 234-6357. Cost is $10 for adults and children. Grout Museum members are $8 each. And the last listing here is for Sunday, November 21st. Have an aural experience at Hartman Reserve. Need a sound bath? Join Colette Ellison, a certified sound healer, from 3 to 4 p.m. Sunday for sound therapy meditation. The session will take place at Hartman Reserve Nature Center, 657 Reserve Drive, Cedar Falls. The vibrations and harmonies of sound healing instruments have been found to bring us back into harmonic balance with the earth. Ellison will first play crystal bowls softly in the background while speaking a meditation, then follow with instruments only for the remainder of the program. The sounds are meant to calm mind and body, reduce stress, boost mood, and increase focus and clarity. The cost is $20. Register and pay for this at a very long website address posted here on the article. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, November 15th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, since there are no obituaries listed in today's paper, we'll continue reading local news before turning to the sports page. Our next article is in the living/advice page, and it's titled, Winterize Your Car. 5 steps for preparing your vehicle to drive in ice and snow. Driving in cold and snowy conditions puts more stress on your vehicle and on you too. But it doesn't have to be that way. Edmunds experts have 5 steps you can take now that will pay off in the coming winter. Step number 1, switch to a set of winter tires. The standard tires that came with your vehicle are likely all seasons, as their name implies. These tires are suitable for all conditions. But think of all seasons as jack of all trades, master of none. You'll get the best grip and stability on snowy or icy roads if you fit your car with dedicated winter tires. These tires are engineered for situations such as heavy snow or black ice. However, you shouldn't keep these specialized tires mounted all year. As such, consider buying a set of winter tires mounted on an extra set of wheels, and store them until winter arrives. It's an added expense and hassle up front, but it makes the seasonal switch a lot easier. Consult your owner's manual for more information on what type of tires to get. No matter which tires you drive on during the winter, be sure to regularly check their air pressure and ensure they're set to your vehicle's recommended pressure. Colder temperatures reduce the amount of air pressure in your tires, and low air pressure can result in suboptimal tire performance and longevity. Step number 2, get your vehicle inspected. Bitter cold can increase wear and tear on certain parts of your vehicle, particularly if it's already old. But to the untrained eye, these potential problem areas aren't always easy to find. The solution? Have a trained mechanic inspect your vehicle. It's better to get your inspection done early enough so that you can deal with potential problems before winter fully sets in. Make sure your mechanic tests your vehicle's battery. Very cold weather will reduce a battery's cranking power. If you've been noticing warning signs of a low battery, such as dim headlights or trouble turning the engine over, it may be time to replace the battery. Don't wait until it's too late. Step number 3. Replace your wipers and fluids. Snow, dirt, and grime constantly build up on your windshield. Examine your wipers to ensure they are in good condition and that they don't skip or smear. If they do, a fresh set of wiper blades is an easy, inexpensive fix. While you're at it, make sure there is plenty of de-icing windshield washer fluid in the reservoir. It's a good time to check your vehicle's other fluids as well. When it comes to motor oil, synthetic oil is typically better suited for very cold temperatures. Step number 4. Consider an engine block heater. This is one for the extremists. Your car has to use more energy to start in the morning if you live in an area where the wintertime temperature routinely drops below zero. Depending on the temperature and the condition of your vehicle, it might struggle to start up at all. You can take some of the stress off by using an engine block heater. An engine block heater plugs directly into your vehicle to keep engine components and fluids warm when it's not being used. That way, when you hop in for your daily drive, it's ready to go. There are several types, and some plug in easily, while others need to be professionally installed. Once ready, all you do is connect the heater to a standard electric outlet a few hours ahead of your outing. And lastly, step number 5, prepare an emergency kit. When all of your preparations still aren't enough, it helps to have a handy set of tools that can get you out of a jam. You should pack an ice scraper to help you clean your windshield in a hurry and get a properly sized set of tire chains when encountering deep snow. Don't forget the gloves. No one wants to fumble around with bare fingers in the blistering cold. Also consider including kitty litter or sand in case you're stuck in ice or snow. Laying down a few scoops can provide the crucial bit of traction you need to get home. If you have the space, a shovel is a smart choice as well. Other good items to keep stocked include jumper cables, road flares, flashlights, blankets, and snacks. Today we have the opportunity to look at the editorials on the commentary page. The first one, Why Unions Are Striking and Winning More Public Support Than in 50 Years, filed by Stephen Greenhouse of the Los Angeles Times. The U.S. is experiencing an unusual surge of strikes. 10,000 John Deere workers went on strike in October, and so did 1,400 Kellogg workers, and now 35,000 Kaiser Permanente healthcare workers are threatening to walk out. Workplace experts generally point to two reasons for this surge. First, after working so hard and often risking their lives during the pandemic, many workers believe that they deserve better pay and treatment. Second, American workers, especially long, underappreciated, essential, and low-wage workers, are suddenly feeling empowered because of today's labor shortage. These factors have certainly helped cause the wave of walkouts, but there's another huge but often overlooked factor behind the strikes. It takes two to tangle. The companies that have faced strikes have often been stubborn and stingy. They're part of a backward-looking group that is clinging to corporate America's philosophy of recent decades. Squeeze your workers and battle your unions. They're acting as if it's still the 1980s when President Ronald Reagan's move to crush the Air Traffic Controllers Union set off an era of anti-union attacks. The corporations facing strikers doesn't seem to realize that times are changing. With a labor shortage giving employees more bargaining power, and with the public feeling greater sympathy for underpaid frontline workers as income inequality soars, neither Deere nor Kellogg seems to have gotten that message. Nor did Nabisco, which recently faced a six-week strike, nor has Kaiser Permanente, which has proposed a two-tier contract in which future nurses and other healthcare workers would be paid 26% to 39% less than current workers. Belinga Redding, a Kaiser Permanente nurse in Woodland Hills, feels insulted by that contract offer after the nurses put their lives on the line day after day for months. Kaiser has offered a raise of just 1% a year for 3 years. Quote, "It feels like almost a slap in the face," Redding told me. Kaiser Permanente, a nonprofit with $45 billion in reserves, maintains that its compensation levels are 27% higher than the average market wage and are unsustainable. Many companies, however, do know it's time to treat workers better. Bank of America has raised its minimum pay to $21 an hour, while Costco has adopted a $15 minimum. CVS says it will raise its minimum to fix $15 by next July, and Amazon is raising its average starting wage to $18 an hour. But some corporations view things differently, seeing it as a time for rollbacks and takebacks. Even though John Deere has forecast record profits of at least $5.7 billion this year, more than double last year's level, and even though its CEO's pay jumped 160% last year, and it raised shareholder dividends by 17%, Deere originally offered its workers a basic raise of 12% over 6 years, which workers said wouldn't begin to keep up with inflation. Chris Larson, a painter at Deere's farm equipment factory in Ottumwa, earns $20.82 an hour after 19 years and complained that Deere first offered him a raise of just $1 in the contract's first year. The strikers were also angry that Deere proposed a new lower compensation tier that would eliminate pensions for new hires. Deere and the UAW leadership reached a tentative deal on a better contract offer October 30th, but union members rejected that offer and remain on strike. A UAW vote on a slightly improved version of that offer is planned for Wednesday. Deere has warned it is the company's last, best, and final offer. Kellogg employees complain of working 30 days straight during the pandemic and frequent 12-hour and 16-hour shifts. After a grueling year, many were upset that Kellogg demanded a two-tier compensation system that would pay new hires $13 an hour less than current workers. The company says they average $35.26 an hour and give them fewer benefits. If today's strikes have a specific cause, it's management's demand for two-tier pay systems that will mean lower wages and reduced benefits, indeed worse living standards, for future workers. To many corporations, demanding two pay tiers makes sense. It placates current employees by maintaining their pay and benefits, while reducing overall labor costs by paying future workers less. Deere and Kellogg say they need a two-tier structure to cut costs and stay competitive. Of course, the reason corporate leaders love two-tier pay systems is that they undermine unions and divide workers. Two tiers foment tensions and make new employees angry at their unions for having agreed to management's demands to pay new people less. And once established, two-tier systems are extremely hard to undo. For unions, it may be tempting to trade away wages and benefits for future workers who aren't there to complain yet. But there's also rising resistance to corporate efforts to push down pay and living standards for the next generation. Quote, "These are our kids and grandkids. We don't want a worse future for them," said Larson, the Deere striker. In taking firm stances on this issue and others, unions are setting an economic justice agenda. By doing that, along with a spate of high-profile strikes, unions have won higher public approval this year than at any time since 1965. The Courier's own Aaron Murphy filed this editorial, "How Not to Do Redistricting." The dust has settled on redistricting in Iowa. The legislative debate is done. The approved plan received strong bipartisan support, and the governor has signed those new maps into law. Iowa has its new political boundaries for the next decade, starting with next year's midterm elections. Other states, including a couple just across the Mississippi River from Iowa, have not been so fortunate. In Wisconsin and Illinois, the redistricting process has been a highly partisan mess, and in Wisconsin's case, still drags on. The contrast speaks to the dangers of partisanship in decennial redistricting and why Iowa's process remains a model for the nation. Iowa's redistricting process is hailed for its nonpartisan nature. Nonpartisan analysts in the state's Legislative Services Agency draw the maps, and state law forbids them from employing political considerations. Only after the maps are drawn do state lawmakers get involved, and even then, they can only vote the maps up or down, with one exception. That one exception did create perhaps a tinge of political intrigue in Iowa this year, with Republicans in full control of state government. In Iowa's process, if lawmakers reject the first two sets of proposed maps, they must accept the third, but they can also amend that third set of maps. Under unified control, a political party could, conceivably, put its thumbs on the scale by amending those maps, thus interjecting partisanship into Iowa's otherwise nonpartisan process. But that didn't happen this year. State lawmakers rejected the first set of maps, but approved the second, and the votes to accept the maps were near unanimous. In Wisconsin, Republicans, and in Illinois, Democrats, state legislatures also are under single-party control. But in those states, like many others, state lawmakers both draw and vote on the maps. What has taken place in those neighboring states has been sadly predictable. Republicans in Wisconsin and Democrats in Illinois have done everything in their power to draw new boundaries that benefit their respective parties. Wisconsin Republicans worked off the same maps they approved 10 years ago, when they also had majorities in the legislature, and held the governor's office. Then, they drew districts that maximized their ability to win majorities in the state house, helping to ensure their party's grip on the state capital for a decade. This time, Wisconsin has a Democratic governor, Tony Evers, who is expected to veto the proposed maps. That will send the issue to the state Supreme Court. Illinois Democrats have been just as creative with their redistricting pencils, drawing maps that will increase their party's stronghold over the state's legislative and congressional districts. The new maps in Illinois would likely yield Democrats an additional seat in the U.S. House, while Republicans would likely lose two, according to WTTW-TV, a public news station out of Chicago. Quote, "Your maps make a farce of democracy, and the process is a charade," said Illinois Republican State Representative Jeff Kaicher, according to WTTW-TV, although that quote could just as likely have been attributed to a Wisconsin Democrat. That's what happens when the drawing of political boundaries is left to the people who will have to earn votes within those boundaries. The people who live in those places, who will be casting votes, become an afterthought. The primary objective becomes political survival. That's no way to run a representative government. That's why Iowa's system is rightly praised and should be duplicated wherever possible and protected here. And now we have an editorial from a guest columnist, Thomas Connors, and it's titled "The Honors Cottage and You and I's Sense of Place." The Iowa Board of Regents deserves credit for giving the community a chance to consider any decision to demolish the oldest building on the University of Northern Iowa campus. The former president's house, now the Honors Cottage, is a familiar landmark along College Street. Passersby admire its beautiful brickwork and architectural charm. Its rich history should be better known. The home is our closest link to the school's founding. It was built in 1890, 14 years after classes began, and is now the only building left on campus from the 1800s. Its first inhabitant was Homer Searley, the most important figure in UNI's history, who lived in the house as president and after he retired. He died there, and his services were held in the front parlor, as was a practice before funeral homes. Professor William Lang wrote the university's history while living there. The house has served as the college hospital and weathered a typhoid outbreak 50 years ago this year. It became UNI's first center for multicultural students, welcoming them for more than three decades. It is the most significant landmark in the history of diversity on campus, the place where the university began its sustained commitment to supporting diverse students. Since 2004, it's housed the Honors Program. There is a special role that an old home can play on a campus filled with cold institutional buildings. It can offer a space for forming community among special groups of students. Over the years, the cottage has been a refuge for ailing undergraduates and more recently for students of color. Honor students now bond in its cozy rooms. It has always found a purpose. Today it is critical to the university's sense of place. The house has found its way into the hearts of students, alumni, and neighbors for generations, ever since the Searleys began entertaining within its walls 130 years ago. To paraphrase Daniel Webster, it is a small cottage, and yet there are those who love it. The historical significance of this landmark to UNI more than justifies its preservation, as does its place in the community's past. To begin, it can be maintained while the campus and community undertake an inclusive discussion about its future. A decade ago, that kind of brainstorming led to local citizens stepping up to preserve a city's old post office, now Bike Deck, when it was threatened with demolition. The campus landmark deserves the same chance. For a start, the cottage could continue to house the Honors Program, which currently utilizes all its rooms. Its first floor is accessible by ramp, while the second only contains a few offices. With some creativity, it could welcome and provide orientation for alumni and visitors entering campus from town, interpretation introducing UNI's history, and would be a wonderful addition to the eve of UNI's sesquicentennial. It could help visitors and students alike to appreciate the historic front campus from the original buildings lost a half century ago to those that have survived and been added as the college grew into a major university. Thanks to the Regents for providing a window for those voices to be heard and giving the community a chance to imagine a more appropriate future for this cottage than a wrecking ball. The university has a strong record on preservation, and recent losses have not raised any outcry. Yet, its oldest building deserves a hearing, and the community deserves a chance to explore its preservation. It stands today as an agricultural gem that embodies UNI's founding, multicultural history, and a sense of community in its bricks. Let's find a way for it to tell that story. Now let's see what's happening on the sports page. UNI claims four wins at tournament. This story filed by Zach Martin, the Courier's sports writer. Wrestling opens season with four wins at Grandview Open. Open tournaments are back after a one-year hiatus due to COVID-19 pandemic, and Northern Iowa made a splash on Saturday. The Panthers sent eight freshmen to the Grandview Open, and half of them walked away with wins as Connor Thorpe, R.J. Weston, Gerard Sima, and John Gunderson all had perfect records. Thorpe cruised through the 141-pound bracket, racking up three majors, a technical fall, and one pin. His lone non-bonus point win came against Missouri's Jeremy Jakowicz, who Thorpe edged 3-2. Weston needed overtime to triumph over J.C. Lukow of Iowa Central to keep his title hopes alive. The 157-pounder proceeded to dispatch his two opponents by a technical fall and pin. Sima and Gunderson had combined seven pins in their bracket wins. Gunderson, at 197, needed just 8 minutes 53 seconds for his four falls. He also beat scrapping partner Adam Amerson 7-3. Sima, at 174, put together a couple takedowns to win 7-0 over Elise Brown, Tun, of Nebraska. His four wins were by bonus points. Aronson and Kael Renavardi, a grad from Don Bosco, each placed third. Caleb Runyon finished sixth and needed to medically forfeit his final two matches. In volleyball, Northern Iowa 3, Evansdale 2. It took the Panthers more than 10 tries to end their match with the Purple Aces, and on the 12th, it finally happened. Taylor Alden's tip kill that carooned off an Evansville block was a match ender, and after 3 hours, you and I pulled off a 23-25, 25-21, 25-21, 33-35, 19-17 thriller inside the Meeks family fieldhouse. It was the second five-setter in a row for the Panthers, 12-17 and 7-9 in the MVC, and the seventh this season. None went longer than the one on the second night of a back-to-back. You and I staved off three match points by tying the final set at 14-16. Evansville kept it square twice before Kira Follert and Alden's kills were the final points of a marathon match. Follert finished with a team-best 25 kills, while Alden chipped in 15 and distributed 31 assists. Emily Holthouse and Carly Spies had double-digit kills. Each side had over 180 attacks, but it was the Panthers that had the better hitting efficiency at .315. The fourth set was the longest. You and I led 24-19 and had those five match points wiped away. It had four more chances, but each time it was either killed by the Purple Aces or an unforced error by the Panthers that kept the set alive. The Panthers scored five of the final 6 points to break a 20-20 tie and claim the second set after Evansdale won the opener. In the third, had three kills and an ace to run off the final 4 points needed to take a 2-1 lead. Alden also had five aces and was one of four players with three block assists. Peyton Ahrensdorf paced you and I's back row with 23 digs. In state swimming, it was perfect. Frericks wins first ever state title in best event. Story filed by Zach Martin, the Courier sports writer. Cedar Falls Grace Frericks had come so close multiple times to winning an individual state title. There were several runner-up finishes on her tally board. Even Saturday started with a runner-up finish in her first of two individual events. Time was running out. Quote, "I had to focus on myself," Frerich said. "I always had that in the back of my head, like, of course, another second place. But that motivated me. This is my last chance," unquote. Yet her best event, the 100-yard backstroke, was still on the docket. It was the final time she stepped into the pool as a Tiger. 54 seconds later, Frericks earned that elusive championship. Going head-to-head with Iowa City West's Scarlett Martin for the first time on the prep level, Frericks won the backstroke in 54.67 seconds at the Marshalltown YMCA that also earned her automatic All-American honors in the event. Quote, "Just seeing it was automatic was a relief," Frericks said. "I've been working so hard this year, and to see it all pay off, I was super proud of it. It was perfect," unquote. Martin, signed to Iowa, and Frericks, a Kentucky recruit, have battled numerous times over their high school and club careers. Martin edged Frericks at state last year, but the latter defeated the former twice in 2021, and the second one was for all the marbles. Quote, "We're competitors, but we're friendly," Frericks said. "My whole goal this year was my state title. I wanted it so bad," unquote. Cedar Falls head coach Chelsea Sizerback felt a similar sense of relief watching her four-year standout touch the finish line in first place. Quote, "Grace is a teachable student," Sizerback said. "I saw her from the first day of the season take the time to slow down and implement the things we talked about to get to that position. She prepared herself so well that I was confident in her. Quote, I was very proud of her," unquote. In the 100 back prelims on Friday, Frerich swam 54.33 seconds. That put her as the fastest qualifier for the finals on Saturday. It was over 0.40 seconds faster than Martin's time. That gave the SEC-bound swimmer a needed confidence boost. Quote, I dropped a lot of time from my best time from club and my best time from my high school career, Frerich said. Seeing that time on the board really gave me the confidence going into finals. I really do have a shot against her, unquote. Frerichs has finished off a prep career that ended in style. Now she will return to the club swimming scene before she bolts for Lexington and begins training for her freshman season next fall. Her house was the host of one last team bonding afterwards. It was a time Frerichs won't soon forget. Quote, we all celebrated and it was super fun, she said, giving one last time all together, soaking up everything we've done the past season, unquote. Sizerback believes the legacy Frerichs is leaving only enhances the Tigers girls swimming program, as the leader of that program is hopeful for another athlete that will be on the same level as Frerichs. Quote, feeling good is not a prerequisite for swimming fast. Working hard is, Sizerback said. Quote, Grace is a perfect example of when you work hard and you focus in, the results will be there. That is a legacy Grace leaves for the team. Quote, there are some junior high girls, freshmen, and sophomores that look up to her. She shows another level of swimming for them that is attainable. Really honored to get to coach her, unquote. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, November 15th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening. It's your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.